Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Beyond the Darkness. This is the Sunday edition of Beyond the Darkness. I'm Tim Dennison for Dave Schrader. We've got a great episode today of Beyond the Darkness, and I'm excited because we're going to be talking all about Tombstone, Arizona today. And in case you've been living under a rock the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about Dave and I going down to Tombstone, Arizona at the end of the month. And you can follow along with us today by going to darknessevents.com about the things that we'll be talking about Tombstone, as there's a huge event coming up in Tombstone that we're going to talk about. It's the 25th reunion of the shooting of the Tombstone the movie. And we're going to talk all about the history of Tombstone today and talk a little bit about the events that are going down there. Tim Fadig is our guest, and he takes care of the promotions for the Crystal Palace down there in Tombstone, Arizona. And we're going to talk with him in just a second. I want to remind you, anything that's going on with Dave or I, you can go to darknessevents.com and check it out for yourself. Dave is in Des Moines, Iowa right now at Wizard World in Des Moines, Iowa. And of course, if you want to go to any of the Wizard World conventions and check it out, whether it be comic books, sci-fi, fantasy, or you just want to see your favorite celebrities at Wizard World, you can, of course, get 20% off your ticket by entering the code DARKNESS in there. I believe it's DARKNESS or DARKNESS 20. Check it out by going to darknessevents.com and enter your code to get 20% off your ticket to Wizard World. That's just one way Dave loves you. Not me, but Dave loves you that way. I mean, follow along, I believe, to Madison, Wisconsin with him to Wizard World, but he's in Des Moines, Iowa this weekend with Wizard World. So check that out as well. darknessevents.com. But like we said, end of the month this month, we'll be in Tombstone, Arizona. Let's bring in right now from the Crystal Palace, Tim Fadig. Good evening, Tim. How are you?
Great. How are you guys doing?
Doing very well. We're excited because we told Lincoln Levere, our friend Lincoln, who is helping to put this whole thing together down there, and they're calling it the 25th Reunion and Freedom Days down in Tombstone, Arizona. When he told us that, hey, you know what? We're putting this thing together, and we'd really like to have you guys down there. We were like, are you kidding? We're in. This is like, for us, this is kind of one of those bucket list things to come down to Tombstone. And we both have kind of a passion for the movie and a passion for Tombstone in itself. And I think for a lot of people, going down to Tombstone, Arizona, and seeing Tombstone in itself is kind of a bucket list type of thing. And let me ask you this, Tim. How did you get involved not only with the Crystal Palace, but with Tombstone in itself? Are you a native of Tombstone, or is it one of those things where you've become enthralled with the history and the lore of Tombstone as an outsider?
Oh, it's been a long-term thing for me. I've been out here for about 20 years now, and always a history buff and a history nut. I've written a couple of books on the history here in Southern Arizona. And it just became this organic thing. I knew some people out here, moved out here, and became more engrossed in the history of the area, the mining frontier, the southwestern development through the late 19th and early 20th centuries. It's a fascinating story. It's one of the reasons the movie's Endure is so popular is because Tombstone, the OK Corral, silver mining, it's a huge chunk of American history, and people want to experience that.
Now, there's something to be said about the Wild West, and like you said, with mining and whatnot, that grabs our imagination. In your opinion, Tim, what is it about that era of our history that really grabs people? Is it the fact that it was so lawless, or is it the expansion? Is it the fact that we were such... Is it the pioneering spirit that grabs us? What is it about that period of our history that is so intriguing?
I think it's all of those things. I don't think it's any one answer. I think it's all of those answers. The cliche draws people in, whether that's Gary Cooper in High Noon or any of John Wayne's films or films as recent as Tombstone or Wyatt Earp in 1993 and 1994. The cliche draws people in, the cowboy on horseback, the painted mountain desert and things like that. But then you get closer and look at the real stories of real people, read the diaries, read the contemporary newspaper accounts, and you see it truly was the triumph of the individual. You didn't have a safety net. You didn't have Social Security. You didn't have support. You didn't have relatives you could go hang out with when things got rough. You had to make it on your own. And a lot of people didn't. And those who did left behind some really harrowing accounts of how they had to get by in Apache country and the economic hardships when the mining booms went bust and things like that. It's an amazing thing. The legend draws people in, but the reality is I think what keeps people coming back to the real places like Tombstone.
You know, with California, people went so far to California for the gold rush. What was it that brought people to Arizona? You had mentioned different mining there, but was Arizona the target first? Was California the target first? Bring us into that part of the history first.
When President Lincoln created the Arizona Territory, it was for very cynical political reasons. He wanted more people in Congress who thought like he did and would vote like he wanted them to, so we bisected the New Mexico Territory and said, this is Arizona, you're all in charge, now do what I want. And Arizona politically was very neglected for the next decade, and then gold was discovered in parts of the territory, and then silver and copper down here in the southern part of Arizona, and suddenly Arizona became interesting. National political figures, they said, oh, well, in that case, we should pay attention and set up army bases and build roads and build infrastructure and give a damn about Arizona after the gold and silver was discovered. And what made Tombstone possible and what made the town of Bisbee a little bit south of us possible was the discovery of silver and gold between 1877 and 1880. Without those two things, Arizona's development would have been set back even farther.
Wow. So now with that, of course, comes settlers, comes industry, and with that as well comes some famous, obviously some famous settlers as well. Talk to us a little bit about some of the more famous people that came through your area.
The best known people to ever set foot in Tombstone outside the Old West history in the 1880s, 90s, and early 20th century were probably Clarence Darrow, the attorney who handled several advocacy cases at the courthouse here in Tombstone, now in Arizona State Park, and General William Tecumseh Sherman, who came through Tombstone in 1882 on a fact-finding tour of the Arizona military bases. He went to his room at the Grand Hotel here on Allen Street, got very drunk, and came out on the balcony and started yelling at everyone, including the mayor and the town's brass band, saying that if it weren't for the mining wealth here, he would recommend giving all of Arizona back to the Indians. And then he went back in his room. So, not really a fan of Arizona, but he came out and wrote the requisite reports. But no, there were all kinds of frontier figures out here who would become famous later through the movies, through lurid dime novels written about them, and some people like Wyatt Earp who were already very famous in their own right. Earp had walked the walk, talked the talk, and he had already been featured in several national magazines by the time he and his brothers came to Tombstone in 1879. They were nationally known people, and they brought a lot of attention with them wherever they went here.
Did that attention that Wyatt Earp had already had, was that positive or negative for the town? I mean, was it more of a circus when he had got there, or was it something that the town really needed at the time to keep commerce going or bring it in?
It depended on which side of the fence you were on. Were you the sheep or were you the wolves trying to get to the sheep? That had a lot to do with your opinion of people like Wyatt Earp. He was a Republican. A lot of people here were Democrats. He was a Yankee. A lot of people here were former Confederates or the families of former Confederates. So ideologically, there were differences drawn. One newspaper here in town called The Epitaph was pro-Republican and pro-big business. The other newspaper was called The Nugget, they were very Southern and Democratic in their affiliations. And so a person like Weigert coming in as a lightning rod for attention, people knew which side to be on almost immediately because they knew who he was and they knew his credentials. He'd been a lawman in western Kansas, was a deputy U.S. Marshal when he and his brothers came down here, and he cast a long shadow. A lot of people thought he was here to take their jobs politically, and that made some enemies for him before he even showed up.
What I find interesting is, you know, we're on the 25th anniversary now of the filming of the movie Tombstone, and we can look back at that movie, and it casts things in a very romantic light. But when you compare movies about the territory to the actual history of the territory, do you find that maybe things are a little too romantic compared to the history of the area, or have we put rose-colored glasses on when it comes to the actual development of the area as to now?
That's one of the things we do to history. We romanticize it. Even when we show violence or brutality, there's still that gloss that Hollywood just applies by nature. Even something as bleak and brutal as Saving Private Ryan, you oversimplify the history, you condense a lot into a short running time. That has to be done. I think historians generally, the biggest gripe with Tombstone to this day is they leave out a lot of the fine detail. The story covered in that movie lasts about 2.5 years. You just don't have that luxury of, you know, a 15-hour miniseries. You've got 2 hours and change to try to tell the story, so you have to oversimplify some things. In terms of some of the revisionist films made over the years, like Doc with Stacy Keach and Harris Yulin, Tombstone at least gets the big picture right, who the good guys were and who the bad guys were. And it sympathizes with the struggles of people like the Earps trying to bring a little bit of civilization to the community and sometimes having to break it in the process. That the police brutality and things like that are age-old eternal questions in our country. And even if it's in cowboy hats and Western backdrops, people relate to the subject. They still understand the controversy.
In other mining towns, you had, I guess, what we would look at as modern-day atrocities of slavery on railroads, things like that. You know, you had prostitution in saloons and whatnot. Did you find the normal Wild West backdrop in Tombstone? Was it your typical Wild West backdrop, or were there other specialties that were going on that might not have been going on in other Wild West towns that maybe needed to be cleaned up, or maybe there were, how should I put it? There were other eccentricities that were special to Tombstone.
Tombstone was every mining camp in the southwestern frontier dialed up to 14. It had all the problems of all those towns and more of them because it had more people. When the OK Corral gunfight happened, there were about 7,000 people living in Tombstone proper. That would be toward the end of 1881.
Oh, wow.
If you factor in the people that lived in the satellite camps around Tombstone, you could easily say the Tombstone mining district encompassed 10,000 people with a police force of less than a dozen men.
Jeez.
So if you knew where to hide out, if you knew where to lay low, you could get away with a lot, just by the sheer force of numbers that were on your side. Even a lot of very good people here became ethically challenged, started to cut corners, would report their livestock to the assessor's office, would go down to Mexico and steal cattle. A lot of perfectly good ranchers from other parts of Arizona, when they came down to Tombstone, fell into that vortex and started running illegal operations on both sides of the border. They'd run Arizona stock to Mexico and sell it, steal livestock in Mexico and run it back up to the markets in Arizona to sell it to the army or to other ranchers who maybe weren't too concerned about where their animals came from. That kind of thing became proverbial. And people like Johnny Behan, the county sheriff, played by John Tenney in the movie Tombstone, showed off their indifference by just not prosecuting these people. They didn't care. It didn't affect them. It didn't affect their constituency. So they said, well, go do what you want to do. Just don't get in my way or make any trouble for me or my deputies. And that was something they were dealing with here while they were working as local and federal peace officers.
And it was just the sheer numbers and the fact that they couldn't enforce it. Was there vigilante justice? Was there, I guess, mob rule in that little cluster there in Tombstone? If the law didn't take care of it, did they take care of it amongst themselves?
there was remarkably little vigilantism in Tombstone. Once in a while, you come across an old tourist pamphlet that will talk about a hanging tree being used where they lynched up offenders, but none of those things ever happened. There were hangings in Tombstone, but they were all legally sanctioned, and they were carried out in the back of the Tombstone Courthouse, the Cochise County Courthouse on Tufnut Street. This was all handled very legally. People were frustrated. Mayor John Klum, who was the mayor of Tombstone at the time of the O.K. Corral gunfight, talked in his memoirs in the 1920s about the creation of something called the Citizen Safety Committee. That was a group of 20 to 30 people who would meet and gripe and vent about how the lawless element was taking a free hand, and they all agreed to meet up and respond if there was ever a problem, but vigilantism never came to that. The police were often outnumbered and overwhelmed, but they did their best, and people respected the efforts they were making. That was before and after Wyatt's brother Virgil was the chief of police here.
Wow. Wow. So we get into a situation where you've had all these people descend on Tombstone. Was it just the fact that they had seen the gold rush and seen how successful, well, the perception is that these people had gotten lucky with the gold rush, and that with other types of mining in Tombstone, that they were going to get just as lucky? Is that why you had these many thousands of people descend on Tombstone?
There was money in Tombstone. Money flowed like water, and no matter what sector business you were in, you were going to do well. You didn't just have to get involved in mining or prospecting. You could run a gambling house. You could run a cigar store. Any kind of business, you would have customers 24 hours a day. Tombstone was like the Vegas Strip. It didn't close. The cliche you see in the old westerns of the barkeep putting his chairs up on the bar, you see that here now, but you don't see it in the 1880s because the miners were constantly going to their jobs and leaving their jobs at noon, at 6 p.m., at 2 in the morning. As a result, the general stores and saloons and gambling houses were open 24-7 to tend to their needs, to provide the services that they wanted. So you could walk Allen Street at noon or at 3 in the morning and see the same mob of people. So whatever kind of business you had, you would do well for yourself. So if people had businesses in the Midwest or in California or in other parts of Arizona, and they heard about the boom in Tombstone, chances are they would say, we need to get in on that. So this place was just packed with speculators. Not all of them were here for the mining, but they were all here because of the mining.
Very interesting. We're back with Tim Fadick. He's in charge of promotions over at the Crystal Palace in Tombstone, Arizona. And we're talking about Tombstone, Arizona today, as Dave and I are going to be down there at the end of the month. We encourage you to join us down there. We'll be recording a couple of podcasts down there from the 25th reunion of the Tombstone cast party, as a matter of fact, the 25th reunion of the cast down there and the shooting of the movie Tombstone. It is the called Freedom Days. It's 25th reunion and Freedom Days from Tombstone, Arizona. It takes place June 30th through July 1st. And you can check out page. There's a Facebook page. It's called Tombstone 25th, and actually we have the link on our page at darknessevents.com. There's also a website at tombstonechamber.com/event/25th reunion and freedom days, Tombstone, Arizona. You can get that link right on our site at darknessevents.com. And you've got a huge event coming up here with this, Tim. I'm telling you, I'm taking a look at the page right now, and just to go over the people that are going to be there, Michael Biehn is the huge guest that's going to be there, a.k.a. Johnny Ringo from the movie. And you've also got Frank Stallone coming out as well. I mean, you've got some huge names coming out from the movie. And you've got lots of events lined up for that weekend. Let me ask you this. Now, when it comes to the differences between, and now people who are somewhat familiar with the history and then familiar with the movie, are they in for a shock when they come down to Tombstone, when they come to see Tombstone?
They are and they're not.
Okay.
A lot of people come down expecting to see the movie set, and when they don't see the movie set, they feel some disappointment. A lot of them also feel the movie was made in the actual town of Tombstone, which of course it was, and it was filmed up at Old Tucson Studios, about 90, 95 miles northwest of it. But then the people who are a little more finely calibrated, you know, they don't see the t-shirt shops or the motorcycle going down the highway. They see the thing under all that. They see the real history. They see what was here. 130, 140 years ago. You know, they see the skull beneath the skin, so to speak, of what Tombstone is. And those are the people that once the bug bites them, they come back year after year, or they're making their multiple of whatever trip down to Tombstone or to Bisbee or other historic sites in Arizona. You can see what's there, or you can understand what has always been there. And for those people, it's a powerful draw, even if it isn't exactly what they saw in Tombstone or Kevin Costner's film or Gunfight at the OK Corral in 1957, for that matter.
There's so much about Tombstone that intrigues me. One of the things that we'll talk about here in the second half of the program is the haunted history of Tombstone. But what intrigues me about the current day Tombstone is, I guess, current day commerce. I understand commerce from the turn of the century, the turn of last century. How does Tombstone make its commerce these days?
Tombstone's first, second, and third forms of revenue are tourism, tourism, and tourism.
Really?
That is the town's industry today.
Okay.
It's one of the reasons we're so glad to be supporting an event like Tombstone 25, because that movie really gave the town its life back, put us back on the map to another generation of historical tourists or film buffs or whatever category of interest people may have to come out here. It put us back on the map in a big way, and still does. To this day, people come in, they come into the Crystal Palace Saloon or other landmarks in town, they're quoting lines from the movie. They've got the red sash on, like Ike Clanton or Curly Bill. You know, that's still an aesthetic that means something to them. In a sense, the movie feels like it's been around forever, and it also feels like it just came out. It has this newness to people. They're discovering it all the time, and that's a terrific thing.
Before the movie had come out, though, how did the town, I guess, support itself? What was it doing to kind of raise revenue?
In the 1920s and 30s, it was pretty bad here. We were down to a few hundred residents. A lot of the old landmarks were boarded up and covered up. And luckily, the motion picture industry came along. And then in the 1950s, the glut of TV westerns that came along. And people were much more into the history of this country, the 19th century history. And they saw places like Dodge City and Tombstone and said, they're real places. We can actually go to these places. Let's do that. And that went on for decades. And that was a big source of revenue for these historical places. But then in the 70s and 80s, it kind of got quiet. Westerns went out of fashion. Guys like Charles Bronson and Clint Eastwood started making, modern police movies. They got away from their classic gunfighter persona. The post-Vietnam era Westerns just were not what they had been before on TV or at the movies, and places like Tombstone suffered for that. So a bit of a decline. The town definitely went through a bit of a decline in that era. And then at Christmas week 1993, this movie called Tombstone comes out, and wow, it's this huge hit with these incredibly bankable actors like Kurt Russell and Val Kilmer. And then it comes to home video, and then every week it's on TNT, TBS, it's streaming on Netflix. You know, it's just this thing. It's out there. And that's, you can't beat that. I mean, Charles Barkley spent years taunting people on the NBA court saying, I'm your Huckleberry. I mean, it just gets in the cultural bloodstream, and everybody gets it. Everybody understands those references. They may not know exactly why they do, or they may have never seen the film themselves, but they get what Tombstone was about for them.
Let me ask you this. When I guess after the movie had come out, did you see a lot of the stars visiting Tombstone, even though the movie was not shot there? Did any of the stars come by Tombstone to visit the town or to kind of embrace the town at all?
Oh, a few did, most definitely. And a few continue to come back years later, even unrelated to events like Tombstone 25 coming up. Sam Elliott's come through a few times. He plays Virgil in the movie. Val Kilmer's been through a few times. Powers Booth, the late Powers Booth, who played Curly Bill Brocious in it.
Mm-hmm.
Tombstone got into their DNA, they would come back in the area. And we see a lot of people who are touring musicians or stand-up comics. They'll play Phoenix or Tucson, and then they'll pop down to Tombstone, for a day or two after the fact. A few years ago, after playing at one of the casinos up in Tucson, Robert Plant of Led Zeppelin was wandering around Tombstone, taking pictures and chatting people up. And you're like, Led Zeppelin, okay, and Tombstone. That's pretty awesome. Everybody's
is.
Heard of it. And if you're in the area, you want to come see the thing for yourself.
I wonder, have you ever heard of a musician like Robert Plant or someone coming down and being inspired after a visit there and incorporating it into their art?
Oh, I would love to think that. I don't know of specific examples, but I would certainly hope, as I said, some people simply see what's here. Others can see beneath that to the elementary history of it, to the real thing. I mean, you go to San Antonio today, the Alamo is surrounded by office buildings, but it's still the Alamo. It's still it's still what it is, regardless of the trappings around it. And that's, I think that's very true for Tombstone and towns like it.
So are you saying that Tombstone is pretty well preserved? You're not having the, you know, like the Starbucks on every corner, or you're not finding that modern day America is pressing in on Tombstone?
In 1960, the entire town was registered as a National Historic Landmark by the U.S. Interior Department. And we're very lucky because that does keep certain things from happening. Certain kinds of signage, certain kinds of buildings being built here. Keeps a lot of business limitations, keeps a ceiling on what businesses can do and what the era of historical significance requires. The McDonald's Corporation, other entities have sniffed around town and said, well, can we do this? Can we do that? And they find out, well, if they do, they'd have to adhere to a very tight standard to not disrupt the historical integrity. We've always said, you know, the worst thing in the world would be to wake up one day and see the golden arches behind the OK Corral sign. Nobody wants to see that. It's not what they come here for. And as much as we'd like certain amenities to be here, the reality is most of the people who live here do their shopping about 20 miles down the road in a town called Sierra Vista, where Fort Huachuca is located.
Huh.
And that's a very good trade-off. We're willing to pay the price to not see the town turn into some garish commercialized thing.
Well, that's refreshing, actually. I mean, it like you pointed out, yeah, the Alamo is surrounded by lots of shops in downtown, and it is a little alarming. And the only other thing that's alarming is there is no basement in the Alamo. I tried looking. Yeah, and Pee-wee's bike is not there either. So we've got the 25th reunion and Freedom Days coming up. I guess I would ask you this, Tim, and that is for people that are coming down to check out the 25th reunion and to see Michael Biehn and the other stars that are going to be there, and what can they expect when they come down to Tombstone?
A very small town with a lot of people in it. Come early, stay late, drink lots of water, and be patient. That's the best things I could tell anybody coming down. It's going to be a great weekend. Freedom Days celebrates America's Second Amendment heritage. Colonel Alan West is one of the keynote speakers for that, the 25th anniversary of the film. Going on along with that the same weekend, it's going to be a madhouse, but in the best way possible. There'll be a lot of very passionate people into American history, into Tombstone history, and the cultural representation of that history. And it's going to be like meeting a lot of your distant cousins. People coming down for that are going to see a lot of kinship. So there'll be a lot of crowds and long lines, but people will be on the same page, and they should expect to, as I said, be patient, but expect to meet some very like-minded folks while you're down here.
Now, I'm looking at the page, and it says, now register now for the Wyatt Earp Vendetta Ride. What exactly is that? I got to know what that is.
The Vendetta Ride is a historical tour that goes through the parts of Cochise County where Tombstone is located that were involved in what is called Wyatt Earp's Vendetta Ride. 5 months after the OK Corral gunfight, Wyatt's brother Morgan, Bill Paxton in the movie Tombstone, was shot and killed while playing a game of billiards, a famous scene in the movie. And Wyatt went a little bit crazy after that happened. He threw down his badge in classic Death Wish or Lethal Weapon style and said, I've got to go outside the law to get some justice. And he spent the next few weeks methodically gunning down the men responsible. Curly Bill Brocious was killed by Wyatt Earp on March 24th, 1882, about 25 miles outside Tombstone. Other men were killed, presumably by the Earp faction, around the same time. And that's referred to by historians as Wyatt Earp's Vendetta. And those sites are findable today. It's a wonderful tour that was put together to take people out to those locations so they could see it up close and personal.
All right. Well, when we come back, we're going to talk about the haunted histories of a couple of different places in Tombstone with our guest, Tim Faddick, who is the promotions director over there at the Crystal Palace. And we'll talk a little bit more about that whole weekend that's going on, the 25th reunion of the cast of Tombstone. It's that time, folks, once again this week, where we go deep into the archives and check out Theater of the Mind. This week, it's a story from Dave's own closet. That's right. It's from Dave's own closet. as he's dug up one of his haunted dolls, and he's going to tell us a little story about, let's just say, a haunted doll that has given him the creeps. Here it is, this week's Theater of the Mind.
Tonight's Theater of the Mind is a story within a story. Who wants to play with Emily? The true account from a listener that wishes to remain anonymous. And Darkness Dave. At an event about a year ago, I had set up a vendor table and at some point used the restroom. When I returned, I found a small cardboard box on my table. Written on top was, "For Dave Schrader." Inside, there was a note. Under the note, a doll. And what I saw next sent shivers down my back. I thought this must be some kind of joke. The eyes were absolutely freaky, unnerving to say the least. Then I read the note. "Mr. Schrader, I've heard you offer to take items with a haunted past. This doll, Emily, has been with us too long already, and I'm hoping you have an idea on how to deal with her." It started off simple enough. I had taken my family to a bustling flea market in the town of Anoka, Minnesota, which you may or may not know is the Halloween capital of the world. We walked around looking through boxes and tables of items on display for sale. I was rummaging through a few boxes of old license plates. I had a pretty healthy collection dating back to the 1930s and was always on the lookout for new ones to add to my ever-expanding collection. As expected, every now and again, my kids would approach me with some item of interest that they had hoped I would buy for them. My daughter, Caroline, had been pretty good and asked me if I would mind getting her a dolly that she found. She informed me that her name was Catherine with a C, not a K, and she would love to bring her home to play with. The doll was only around $3, and I nodded in agreement and said that would be fine. She laid the doll on top of the items that I had pulled to purchase and wandered off to join her mother. The vendor tallied my items, and I handed her $30, and she bagged up our goods and sent me on my way. I returned to the car to put the bags I had accumulated into the trunk and returned to my family. We had a great time, and after a number of hours, we decided it was time to go home and find places for all of our new treasures at home. Halfway home, I blew my left passenger tire, and I had to limp off to the side of the road to get out the spare. When I opened the trunk, the bags were all off to the left side, but there, laying on top of the spare tire, was my daughter's doll. Now, it must have fallen out of the bag when we were driving. I grabbed it, tucked it back in the bag, and removed the spare with my jack. Oh, wouldn't you know it? My spare was flat as well. So I made a quick call to AAA. Eventually, they arrived and got us back on the road. We got home and divvied up our items. When I called my daughter to retrieve her doll, she squinched up her face and brashly announced that that was not Catherine. She was very upset and demanded that we return the doll and get her doll back. After explaining that the flea market was closed and would be back open in a few weeks, I agreed to take her back to return the doll if she wasn't happy with her new friend by then. I figured after 2 weeks, it would be a non-issue, and she would have accepted this new doll by then. My daughter agreed and snatched the new doll up and made her way up the stairs. Well, most of the way up the stairs. That's when I heard the thump, thump-thumping of her little body falling down the stairs. She hit the bottom hard and let out a howl that could break the toughest man's heart. I ran to her and found her arm bent in an impossible angle. She had broken her arm and dislocated her shoulder. I lifted her in my arms and we sped off to the hospital, where they reset her arm and shoulder and casted her. It was a long day, turning into an even longer night. When we got back home, I carried my little girl to her room and laid her down to sleep. Her new doll was sitting prominently on her bed, eagerly awaiting my daughter's return. "Look," I told my daughter, "it's Catherine with a K, and she'll keep you company." With that, my daughter tossed the doll to the ground and informed me, "That is not a Catherine with a C or K, Daddy. Her name is Emily," and my daughter made that very clear. She didn't want Emily on her bed. A few hours later, I was stirred from my sleep by the loud bang that rang out from upstairs and the wailing cry that followed. My daughter had rolled off her bed in her sleep onto her sore shoulder and broken arm. It was heartbreaking to see her gasp and sob, huge, dollopy tears streaming from her eyes. And as I lifted her back to her bed, I was surprised to see that Emily was sitting there. My daughter must have had a change of heart after all, or so I thought. Carolyn cried out, "No, Daddy, I don't want Emily in my bed." And again, she tossed her to the floor. That was only the start. A week passed, and it was a rough one. It seemed anything that could go wrong for my daughter did go wrong for her. Tripping, bumping her head, a mysterious black eye. I was starting to worry that the neighbors would think I was abusing my daughter. But I started to notice every time something bad happened that resulted in my daughter getting hurt, that damn doll was close by. I shook off my superstitious thoughts and went about my life until the night I saw my little girl standing there, mostly out of her room, throwing me kisses and telling me goodnight as she was about to crawl into bed. Her hand was grasping the doorframe, her lithe body leaning out, her face bright and sweet, until I saw the door slam, catching Caroline's little fingers between the door and the door frame. Again, she howled out in pain. I ran up to her and had assumed one of my other kids must have been in there horsing around and accidentally shut the fingers in the door. When I threw open the door, the room was empty, except for that damn doll, sitting in the suspiciously close area near the door. I know it sounds crazy, but after my wife and I tended to my daughter's bruising hand, I put her back to bed and I grabbed that doll on my way out. I lifted it to my face and barked in its face as I stared deep into its cold, dead glass eyes. "You're gone. You're out of here. You're nothing but bad luck." I brought her to my garage, threw her in a blanket that I kept in the trunk of my car, and slammed the trunk closed. I was determined to return that jinxed toy and get Catherine with a C for my daughter. The following week, the flea market was back up and running. I drove down with my daughter in hopes to find the doll she actually wanted and to return the devil doll that we had gotten by mistake. To my utter horror, when I opened my trunk, I found Emily laying there, far from the blanket she had been wrapped up in. And her eyes? Well, something had happened. I thought it must have been the heat and humidity of being stored in my trunk. But her eyes had changed. They were red. Not kind of red. Very red. I felt sick to my stomach. I approached the vendor with my daughter in tow. Thankfully, sitting atop the display case was Catherine with a C. And a very smiley vendor. He greeted us with a smile and said to my total confusion, "I'm glad you came back. You forgot your doll that you paid for last time." I informed him that somehow the dolls had gotten switched, and I handed him Emily. He told me in no uncertain terms that was not his doll, and handed both Emily and Catherine back to us. We were surprised. How the hell did she get in our bag then? We returned to the car, and I placed both dolls in the trunk of the car for the ride home. When we pulled into the driveway, I opened the trunk to retrieve Catherine and to throw Emily away. When the trunk latch popped, my heart sank. There was Emily, dead center in the trunk. Next to her was Catherine, whose pretty little porcelain face was crushed. I didn't know what to say. What could I say? I had a killer jinx doll? Then I remembered you, and I wrapped her up, stuck her in the box you now hold, and decided she had to go. She's been in my trunk in a taped box since that day. I opened it only enough to slide that note in and make sure the damn thing was still in there. So that's my story, and yes, I'm sticking to it. Goodbye and good riddance. Thanks for taking care of this. That's how the note ended. Now, I did as I always do. I took the doll home and was met with a lot of curiosity from my daughters when I came in with a box. The girls wanted to know what I'd gotten them. I told them it was a haunted doll and that a listener had dropped it off to me, and that I was going to wrap it in bubble wrap and stick her in the far garage along with the other satanic siblings I store out there. They demanded to see it. After a few minutes, I relented and told them they'd be sorry. They laughed and rolled their eyes at me until I drew Emily out of the box and turned her around. The blood-red eyes effectively freaked them out, as well as my wife, who insisted we just go toss this thing right now. But I decided to wrap her and store her away. I've had a calling from many listeners asking me to sell my weird dolls, so I've been considering it. I went to the garage to do a quick check and see how many I had and what I wanted to do to part with them. When I flipped on the light and approached the back of my garage, I was stunned to see that Emily was sitting atop the closed box of dolls. No bubble wrap, and the box was closed. It was then that I thought, if I was ever going to part with a doll, this would be the one. I wrapped her up again and placed her in the box and placed another box on top. A week later, The box on top had been toppled to the floor, and Emily was again atop the box of dolls. She was not hurting anybody in my home, and I cannot say she's possessed or even truly haunted, but after grilling my kids, they assured me they had not touched her, nor would they want to. So, it's time for Emily to go. And now I ask you, who wants to play with Emily?
Welcome back to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm Tim Dennis in for Dave Schrader this Sunday. And Tim Fadig is our guest. He is the promotions director out at the Crystal Palace in Tombstone, Arizona. And we are talking about Tombstone today as Dave and I will be down there for the big 25th celebration of the movie Tombstone. And there's a huge, huge celebration going on down there. You can check out everything there is about the celebration at darknessevents.com. We're going to be down there June 30th through July 1st, and it's the 25th Reunion and Freedom Days down there in Tombstone, Arizona. Man, I'm telling you, there is lots of stuff going on down there, folks. Michael Biehn, a.k.a. Johnny Ringo, is going to be down there. Frank Stallone's going to be down there as the cast gets together and reunites for this huge event. Freedom Days is going on down there. There's a Buffalo Soldiers parade down there. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West will be there. Lots of stuff going on, and you're going to want to be down there as Dave and I will be recording a couple of podcasts down there as well. Man, I'm telling you, we're going to have a great time down there. We want you to join us as well. Tim, I'm telling you, we're looking forward to it, as this is a bucket list thing for Dave and I to actually go down to Tombstone, see Tombstone, and spend some time down there. When we were approached with it, we were like on pins and needles type excited to finally get a chance to come down and see Tombstone. And one of the things that's really got us excited is the haunted history of Tombstone. Now, we know it's rich with haunted history, of course, with all the different incidents that have happened down down there in Tombstone. Now, we always hear about the world-famous birdcage down there. In Tombstone. So why don't we start there? Why don't you give us an overview of the Birdcage and some of the haunted history there?
The Birdcage Theater was a gambling house and a saloon that opened up in the summer of 1881, reopened a few months later that December, Christmas week, as the Birdcage Theater, and it was open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for nearly a decade. Gambling and drinking and all kinds of other illicit activities went on all day and all night. And unfortunately, over the course of that near decade, there was a lot of violence. There were shootings, there were stabbings, sometimes involving the ladies who worked there, sometimes involving the high-stakes gamblers who worked there, or somebody passing through and got caught in the middle of things. And as a result, there are some unsettled spirits that are associated with that building. Some are pretty notorious to the property, and others they're still researching and trying to figure out who exactly these people were in their lifetimes.
Now, that's kind of a ghost hunter's mecca there, that the Birdcage is. Do you find that you get more paranormal investigators down there, it seems, these days than anything?
Oh, quite a bit. And throughout the year, there are a number of documentaries that have highlighted Tombstone's paranormal past. And whenever those recur, we see a spike in interest, people reaching out to us via phone or email and saying, we want to come down. How can we do that? And we're glad to see everyone. I mean, some people's interest is purely historical. Some are Western movie buffs, and some are into the paranormal aspects of the area's history. And we're glad to see everyone who's interested in Tombstone and interested in our 19th century legacy.
Now, you yourself, you're the promotions director of the Crystal Palace. And tell us a little bit about the Crystal Palace and its history. Not only just the haunted history, but the history itself of the Crystal Palace.
Oh, it's a great landmark. It's one of the anchors of the whole historic district here in town, right at the intersection of 5th and Allen Streets, where there were numerous gunfights throughout the 1880s and 1890s. It was originally the Golden Eagle Brewery, and opened up as the Golden Eagle Brewery in 1879. After a couple of fires took place in town, the building was remodeled and reopened in July of 1882, a few months after the earth took off, as the Crystal Palace Saloon. While it was still the Golden Eagle Brewery, Wyatt Earp had an interest in the gambling that took place here. Musky and Frank Leslie, another Tombstone gunfighter, was employed here, and so were people like Bat Masterson while they were passing through town. It gained a pretty solid reputation among high-stakes gamblers. Not a lot of violence took place compared to some other establishments that were the more hole-in-the-wall persuasion, but this was a high-end establishment for almost the entire decade that Tombstone was a mining center. During Prohibition, the saloon was shut down, and for the next few years, it was a variety of other things, including a general store and a movie theater. And then in the 1960s, the property was restored to its current appearance, and the saloon aspect of it, not the gambling, of course, resumed, and people can come in today and see it look exactly like it did when people like Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday used to hang out here.
I find it interesting when a place has been renovated, you know, a couple of times, especially the flip to a movie theater and then back again. Is there any documentation from when they flipped from one type of establishment to another of any paranormal activity where things might have been more active and then settled back down again?
Oh, definitely. One of the highlights of our display here in the Crystal Palace are a couple of gaming wheels that were used in the building throughout the three decades that gambling was legal during a territorial era of Tombstone and Arizona's history. And those wheels are operated on an electric switch that we can turn on and turn off as we like. The problem is sometimes they turn on by themselves.
Hmm.
At odd hours. Sometimes we're open for business, sometimes we're closed. So something or someone seems to really like those gaming wheels and wants them to operate maybe a little more than we ourselves want them to.
Hmm. Very interesting. When it was a movie theater, were there things going on while it was a movie theater? When it had converted over, were they still having the same amount of activity?
In the 1930s, people reported smelling smoke a lot in the building to the point they were afraid something had caught fire, even though the building didn't burn any time after the 1880s. But people would smell smoke and run around. There'd be a commotion. They'd go upstairs and look around, come back down. They couldn't find anything on fire, nothing smoldering, not even a cigar in an ashtray. But there would be heavy premonitions of smelling smoke at different points in the property. This was reported in the contemporary press several times in the 1930s and 40s.
Very interesting indeed. Any apparitions that were sighted at the Crystal Palace? Did people see anything physically as far as ghosts?
We've had people contact us regularly over the years saying that they took pictures here in the Crystal and found abnormalities in them, be they the bending of light or outlines of people. Again, sometimes when we're open for business, and sometimes after we've closed, and people are just grabbing snapshots on their way out the door. And it's certainly food for thought, and a number of us have looked at the files. Even some more skeptical employees have scrunched up their faces and said, I want to look at that and try to take it apart. And sometimes they just sort of fall back in silence and say, well, it speaks for itself.
Now, I know you've probably had some more well-known investigators come through the Crystal Palace. Have you ever had anything that's truly baffled any of them that they couldn't seem to figure out?
Several groups have come through, some better known, some lesser known. I have had experiences in the basement of our building where the only sounds should be organic to the nature of a 130-year-old building with its normal creaks and groans, and hearing conversations taking place in the basement level when no one has been down there except the people with the recording equipment themselves. That's happened on more than one occasion, and it always leaves us pretty interested to find out what exactly is going on down there.
Hmm. What's the most unusual thing that you've heard caught on an EVP or caught on a recorder as far as any type of EVP?
Screaming.
Screaming, really?
That's one that always sticks out in my mind. There was a tour down there in about 2004, 2005 era, going back a few years, where one of the recordings came up, and it was the usual fill of quasi-white noise and a very sharp, shrill scream. and then resumption of the quasi white noise again. That was a very short recording, but a very memorable one.
And there is nobody else in that area that could have possibly been screaming.
At 4 o'clock in the morning in the basement of a large old building like that? No. No, I racked my brain quite a bit trying to come up with something of a more hands-on explanation, and I never could, and the people who were with me at the time couldn't either.
Interesting. Very interesting indeed. So now, having worked intimately in this place, in the Crystal Palace, is there anything that ever unnerves you, or is this second nature to you when you walk through?
It's second nature now.
Nothing.
It has to be. If you're going to be in a place like this for that length of time, you make your peace with it. Whatever you think you're experiencing or whatever you think you're around, you have to find your own comfort level with it. If you can't, it's really not a good place to be. If you're a very nervous person or very concerned by these things, you really shouldn't be around it as often as the people who live and work here are. I say that for most of us who are in town on a regular basis, day in and day out. You make your peace with it. You make your peace with your understanding of it.
I know people that work in different haunted locations, extremely haunted locations in old theaters and whatnot, and they talk to some of the spirits and even try to befriend some of the spirits and even develop a bit of an attachment to them. Do you feel attached? Not like an attachment, but do you feel attached to the spirits, like a fondness for them?
Oh, absolutely. You become comfortable with it over time, and you begin to miss it when it stops, for whatever period of time that it does stop.
Do you ever find yourself in conversation with them, like when, you know, walking in, saying good morning like you would to a coworker?
Not here, but in other places in town, other landmarks with certain associations. There's a large two-story adobe building on Highway 80 as people drive in called Shifflin Hall. It was built in 1881 by Ed Shifflin and his brother Al, two of the miners who discovered the Tombstone Mining District. And in the lobby of the building, there's an immense, 25, 30-foot high oil painting of Ed Shifflin that was done during his lifetime. And as you go in and out of Shifflin Hall, you simply say, good morning, Ed, or good night, Ed, or talk to the painting as you go by, because there's something residual of the Shiflins in the property. It's one of the customs. You have to say hi or bye to the painting as you go in or out, or you're not going to have a good time there.
Very interesting indeed. Wow. Well, folks, to you it may seem unusual. To me, it's not so unusual. I used to say hi to some of to the projectionists in the Mounds Theater. I would do that before IWI cards because I had to go up to the balcony. So it's not unusual to me to hear that, but to some people it may seem a bit unusual. We're visiting with Tim Fadig, who is the promotions director over at the Crystal Palace. I'm still contemplating driving by and saying hi or bye to a spirit. How old would that spirit be over there that you were talking about in Tombstone that you have to say hi or bye to?
Well, Ed Shifflin was in his late 20s when he made the Silver Strike in 1877. Mm-hmm. So he's not doing too bad for a nearly 170-year-old.
Yeah, all right. So that's a lot of high and buys, actually. We're talking to Tim about Tombstone, Arizona. The festival is going on at the end of the month, June 30th through July 1st. Dave and I will be down there. It is the 25th Reunion and Freedom Days down there in Tombstone, Arizona, June 30th through July 1st. All the details are at darknessevents.com, and we hope to see you down there. Please make the trip down there to Tombstone. Dave and I will be doing a couple of podcasts that you'll be able to hear here on Podcast One, and we'll be talking with Michael Biehn, a.k.a. Johnny Ringo from the movie. Frank Stallone will be down there. A few of the stars of the movie will be down there as well. And we're going to have a great time down there. We hope that you'll join us down there in Tombstone as well. Now, Tim, the Buford House. I hear that Dave and I will be having some intimate knowledge of the Buford House. Is this true?
Oh, absolutely. It's one of the highlights of any paranormal investigation centered on the town of Tombstone. It gets away from the gunfighters and the soil doves and the better-known personalities and deals with some really small scale but deeply personal cases. The Buford House is just one of them. A couple of years after the OK Corral gunfight took place at the residence of George Washington Buford, there was an attempted murder-suicide.
Wow.
A distraught young man came to the house, shot a woman there, shot himself. He survived, he didn't. And a great deal of the paranormal activity at that property. And there's a lot centers on their case.
Now, what kind of stuff happens as far as paranormal activity there at the Buford House?
Physical disturbances, sonic disturbances, all kinds of manifestations. A number of people have lived there over the years since these incidents have begun to take place. And apparently the activity there depends on how invasive the people living there are. The people who've made their peace with the property and with the history of the property that they occupy, the things aren't that bad. But when there's unease there, when there's concern there, the incidents are more, to use a term, in your face, more aggressive.
So it depends on the uneasiness of the person that's there, that tends to go there? And that's what...
Exactly.
Really?
Going back decades. Yeah.
Really?
There's a whole audit trail of these stories all associated with Stafford Street and the properties immediately around the Buford House, but the Buford House itself is the epicenter for all these stories.
Hmm. So if you walk in with the idea that something bad is going to happen, it probably is.
Exactly.
What's the strangest, most bizarre thing you've heard of happening at the Buford House?
There's a story going back about 25, 30 years where a door actually wrenched itself off the hinges. Not the front door, but one of the side doors in the property. The door simply disconnected completely from the door frame. That's pretty hands-on. That's pretty intense.
Wow. Interesting. And what type of characters have people seen at the Buford House as far as spirits?
The most recurring story is of a young man wandering around as though he's lost, wearing normal Victorian clothing, which to us would be considered quite fancy, something like a three-piece suit, mm-hmm. and a bowler or a normal medium crown hat. He's walking around as though he's there to meet someone, or he's looking for someone and never quite finds them. That has been reported late at night and also early in the morning, at 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning. Not so much during the middle of the day, but overnight in the early morning hours, those sightings are the most commonplace around that location.
Hmm. Very interesting. So with the Buford House, now I understand it. Now this is a bed and breakfast, correct?
It has been. Yeah.
It has been. Is it currently operating as one?
Most recent ownership, I believe it's a private residence.
It's private. Okay.
But it has been a B&B over the years.
Okay. So is it something where if you were a private paranormal investigator, you could get access to it if you wanted to investigate now?
People have had pretty good luck gaining access to the property.
Okay. So if a group out there wanted to investigate, they probably could contact the owners and see if they could get in there.
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
Most of the people living in Tombstone understand what goes with that, where people are interested in the history of your property, interested in the background of it, if you are in a historic home or just in a historic part of town. And they're pretty conversational. When people come up respectfully and say, hey, I'm from such and such a place, I'm interested in the history, or what do you know about your house, they will gladly tell you what they know. Some people haven't done a lot of research on their houses. Some people will hand you their own journal of research notes that they've made. It's great to see so many dedicated grassroots historians in a town like this, and they're very communicative when people visit and they want to talk about the history they're also passionate about.
Very interesting. Yeah, there's not, I tell you, especially in bigger towns, there aren't a lot of people that know the history of their house. And I mean, there's a website we promote on here quite often called DiedInHouse.com. That provides a lot of that stuff for you if someone has passed away in your house or whatnot. But a lot of people don't know that. I mean, they just kind of move into a house, assume that, you know, there's that wipe the slate clean in your own mind type thing. When you move into a house, it's my house. No one's ever been here before. I don't care if somebody lived here before. It's mine now, and I'm going to blindly move in, and this is mine. But a lot of, you know...
Oh, very much the opposite here.
Yeah, I think there's kind of an ownership of the history that much more so, I think, in probably in Tombstone than a lot of other cities, wouldn't you say?
Oh, sure. And thankfully, there are so many great resources out there online, like Ancestry.com and other sites where people can do their own diligence. They can go to the historical societies here right up in Tucson and find the old newspaper accounts, and people want to know more. That's a great thing in a town like this with so much history. And when people come in looking for answers, there are a lot of people who can try to help them find those answers.
You bring up an interesting point, Tim, and you're bringing me off on an interesting tangent here. You brought up Ancestry.com, and I'm interested to know, are there any descendants of Wyatt Earp that are still in Tombstone?
There aren't, for a couple of reasons. Okay. One, Wyatt Earp didn't have any direct descendants.
All right.
Never had children who lived to adulthood. His closest relations today, and there are a few, are descended from his half-brother, Newton Jasper,
okay,
who was a few years older than Wyatt and never got bit by the gambling wanderlust. And he spent most of his life in Kansas and retired out in California in the 1900s. Those would be the closest blood relations of Wyatt Earp. But no, after the boom went bust, most of Wyatt's contemporaries pulled up stakes and left. They were here for the gambling and the saloon keeping and making the money. And as times changed and the town's fortunes changed, they went to California, back to the Midwest. Some of Wyatt's peers wind up in Alaska during the gold rush in the 1890s or early 1900s. Hmm. And some just fall off the face of the earth. But for the Earp brothers themselves, they left here about 5 months after the OK Corral gunfight. After Morgan was murdered, Wyatt went to Plan B immediately. He planned on staying here, even after all that had happened. And he felt that eventually their fortunes would change and he could get back into politics. But after Morgan was killed, he knew they'd all be dead before that happened. So they relocated, and in Wyatt's case, he went out to Los Angeles and spent most of the rest of his life based in Southern California.
Very interesting. So do you find that it was kind of a stop in the annals of history? It was just kind of a stop in between mining towns for a lot of the more famous characters in the play?
Absolutely. People come here and bemoan the fact that a number of landmarks are no longer here, but the reality is it's amazing that any of these things survived. The typical boom town was very cannibalistic. Buildings were torn down and rebuilt as something else, because there was no sense of permanency here. There were a dozen saloons in this town before there was a school. There were two dozen saloons here before there was a post office. People really had no sense that this would be a long-term thing 50 or 100 years after the fact, that people would still be living here. They thought, well, it's a boom town, in 10 years we'll all be gone somewhere else, and this place will be reclaimed by the desert. And it's come close a few times, but people just haven't given up on it. There's a reason this place is called the town too tough to die.
Very interesting. You mentioned the off-air we were talking, you mentioned the courthouse as one of the more haunted spots in town. Give me a history of why the courthouse is so haunted.
The courthouse here began its term of service in January of 1883 as the Cochise County Courthouse and remained in service until 1930. The courthouse was decommissioned when the county seat moved down to the town of Bisbee. And in 1960, the Arizona Park Service took over the building and eventually opened it as a museum. There were a number of hangings in the courthouse, a number of high-profile trials, murder trials, labor unrest trials. Even in the early 1900s, there were cases of sedition and other related things where people were running munitions into Mexico during the Mexican Revolution, and their trials were held right here in Tucson. So there was just so much unease and so much unrest associated with this place. At least two of the men who were hanged here, the Haldeman brothers, who were executed in 1900, are widely regarded by legal historians as the victims of a frame-up. And a lot of the unrest associated with the courthouse is thought to be associated on the paranormal level with the case of the Haldeman brothers.
Hmm. You know, it's funny. We run across a lot of haunted jails in paranormal investigating, and I wonder to myself, why that would be the last place that you'd want, whether it be a residual haunting or whether it be an active haunting, especially if it's an active haunting, why that would be the last place you would want to be. And I understand that there's, you know, lower level energies that would reside there, or would think that they couldn't move on or be afraid to move on, you know, afraid of being judged or whatnot. But to be stuck, you know, I mean, to be stuck in that place to me would just seem like kind of like hell on earth, wouldn't you think?
And it was for a lot of the people who were there at the time. It was a very rough place for all the wealth and gaudiness of a boom town like Tombstone. There was a lot of hardship, and a lot of the people who became cattle thieves and stage robbers, they did so out of pure desperation. And as you see in most places with large economic disparities, some people said, I feel bad for these people, and some people said, throw them in jail, you know. And as there were social reforms in Europe and other parts of the United States, there were people on both sides of the issue right here in a town like this one.
Mm. Are there other places that would be of interest to paranormal investigators there in Tombstone that they should check out while there?
Oh, my knee-jerk response is everywhere. I mean, every place that has history has stories, you know. They may be lesser known or better known, such as the Birdcage Theater or the Crystal Palace. But if you walk down Safford Street, you'll see row after row of painted ladies, these great old houses from the 1880s, 1890s, and 1900s. Third and Safford Street, there's St. Paul's Episcopal Church, the oldest Protestant church in the entire state. There are so many locations that have stories and would be worth investigations. If people have time while they're down here, they have time for breakout sessions to wander around, I would tell everyone, just walk down Safford Street. You'll pass the Buford House and quite a few other places with stories unto themselves.
All right. Well, again, the weekend is June 30th through July 1st. Make your plans right now. Come join Dave and I. We'll be down there in Tombstone, Arizona for the 25th Reunion and Freedom Days in Tombstone. And Michael Biehn is the big guest there, who is Johnny Ringo in the movie. Frank Stallone will be down there. A bunch of the different stars of the movie of Tombstone will be down there. There's a Tombstone cast party. There's lots of fun down there. They're going to have a parade down there, a Buffalo Soldiers parade. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West will be there as well. And by all means, go to darknessevents.com, click on the banner, see the website and the Facebook page there, and make plans to attend, because it's going to be a huge weekend. We're going to record a couple of podcasts down there, and like I said, we'll be down there as well, and we're looking forward to it, Tim. We're looking forward to coming down to Tombstone. It's a once-in-a-lifetime type event for us, and a bucket list event for us as well, so we'll look forward to seeing you there as well.
It's going to be a great weekend. We're looking forward to you guys coming down here, and we appreciate everyone whose interest in Tombstone keeps this place alive. It's the effort of a lot of people, including the folks who come here and talk about the history and what you guys do with your programming. We're delighted you wanted to talk about Tombstone, and you'll be coming down here.
Absolutely. Be sure to join us again next weekend, folks. We've got a huge lineup of shows for you next weekend. We've got Theater of the Mind again next weekend for you, and more strange and supernatural news for you on Saturday. And of course, True Crime Tuesday is coming up on Tuesday. We've got a full lineup of shows for you next week. For Dave Schrader, I'm Tim Dennis, and this has been the best in paranormal talk radio. This has been Beyond the Darkness.
Looking for a little Hollywood-style fun? Check out Ryan Seacrest's 10K Ways exclusively at Chumba Casino. There's 10,000 ways to play. Get spinning for free at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.